The following series contains some graphic images and is intended for a mature audience.
Hello, is that Billy O'Sullivan?
That's right.
Hi, Billy. My name is Jennifer, and I am a radio reporter, and I'm here with my husband, and we're doing a piece on the Sophie Toscan du Plantier murder. We're here for a few days, and we just wanted to come in...
2 days before Christmas, 1996, a French woman was murdered in a remote part of West Cork, on the southwest coast of Ireland. She'd been badly beaten and was found in her nightclothes and laced-up boots, tangled in briars and barbed wire by the path below her holiday home. To the police, it looked like she'd been running from someone, and this was as far as she got. There were no witnesses, no forensics, no clear motive. Down an isolated lane, there was just the body of a woman that people knew little about.
On the night that she died, Sophie stopped by O'Sullivan's pub in the small village of Crookhaven. Billy O'Sullivan was behind the bar, and he was the last known person to see her alive.
If I knew she was going to be murdered, I would have remembered everything, right?
In West Cork, it's simply known as the murder, because there hasn't been another murder that anyone can remember. 20 years on, the case is still open.
I think for the woman's soul, for the family.
For her family.
You know? It's like the casket can't be closed.
To understand why and what that's meant for West Cork, we have to go back to the 1970s, where this all began. This is West Cork, an Audible original series. I'm Sam Bungie.
I'm Jennifer Ford, and this is episode 1, Blow-ins. When Len Liptick was in his 20s, he wore a shirt and tie and punched in as an accounting clerk in central London. It was the 70s, and Len figured if the job and smog didn't finish him off, nuclear annihilation would. He hated work, and he hated London. He wanted out, and he'd heard about a place called West Cork.
One day, we got on it. Got the tickets, bought a car for, I think it was £7.50. And at Morris Thousands, had a trailer on the back. I had £25 in my pocket and left for Ireland.
When he got to Ireland, Len drove west as far as he could, out onto a mountainous peninsula on the far southwest coast. He stopped in a hillside village, found a piece of land with an old ruined cottage on it, learned to weave belts from wool that he sold at the market, and drank the local illegally brewed alcohol, poutine.
I mean, I had nothing, really. I had my house, my ruin, no electric. I had my donkey and cart.
Len the accountant had vanished. In his place was Len with the donkey and cart.
Yeah, it was like a dream come true. It was incredible, really.
It was a hideaway at the edge of Europe, a community that grew by word of mouth. People floating on the breeze into West Cork. The locals had a name for them. They called them blow-ins. Like a lot of places out on the fringes, West Cork attracted people for all sorts of reasons. You could reset or reinvent yourself. Maybe you were looking for something. Or maybe you were running from something. As another blow-in put it.
There were people coming in to West Cork, which is sort of wild and woolly, the wild west of Ireland, you know. And nobody knew their past. You could make that up, couldn't you? You could be who you wanted to be, rather than who you really were.
Which eventually led to trouble, when one blow-in was murdered and another was suspected of doing it. The suspect was arrested a couple of times, but there was no hard evidence of any kind, and the case never went anywhere. The town turned against him, branded him a murderer. Years went by, and where you might expect him to leave, he dug in. He stayed in his cottage just a few miles from town, and everyone else was supposed to go on with their lives, with this horrid event unresolved and the embodiment of all their unsettled nerves still resolutely among them.
I see him in the market, you know, selling his pizzas there. And really, he's always trying to be normal and trying to get people to like him. But we all know, don't we? You know?
Barry, it's 20 years this Christmas. I saw the date last night and did a quick double take. 20 years this Christmas since Sophie Toscan de Plantier was found dead near Skull. And this investigation continues apace.
Hard to believe that. 20 years ago tomorrow, that news broke that her body had been found. We remember her on the programme today.
The first time we saw the suspect was in 2014. One Sunday morning in our London flat, we read a short piece about the case in a British newspaper. The suspect was suing the Irish police, the guards, for wrongful arrest, claiming 20 years of harassment and mental torture, which he says has ruined his life. That without having the evidence to actually charge him with anything, they'd managed to convince an entire country that he was guilty of murder. He was tall and powerful looking, striding into the courthouse wearing a black greatcoat and a scarlet red scarf that had been caught by the wind. He had big bushy eyebrows and was staring down the camera lens. It was a face you could read things into.
And it was a face that would launch us down a 3-year rabbit hole. We'd spend a winter in West Cork, and then a summer, trying to make sense of an investigation where everything is still on the table, where witness stories are still changing 20 years on. We'd go through it so often with anyone who'd listen that one friend suggested podcast as a name for the baby we had while making this. And we'd go so mad thinking about who might have done it, we started to take seriously the guy who thinks that the murderer was a horse.
We'd spend time with the victim's family. Why was a woman with a husband and child in France, alone in West Cork, just days before Christmas? And we'd sit for hours with the suspect and his accusers. What was it about this man that has people so convinced he did it? How is an innocent person supposed to act, anyway?
How a guy looks or carries or the size or the height or the weight of him or the presence he might have or whatever kind of a demeanour he might give off is completely irrelevant.
Exactly, that's exactly what I think.
And do you think that we as a country should be saying, like, to be honest with you, there are those that think he did it and those that think he didn't, right? And he knows that and he regards himself as the chief suspect. But like maybe Ireland should be saying, we need to leave this guy alone.
He's doing everything in his power to try to prove that he's innocent. That is not supposed to be the way the law works. It's supposed to be you're innocent and the state is supposed to prove that you're guilty.
We decided to go to Dublin to sit in on the trial and see for ourselves. And we found that we weren't the only ones intrigued by this man. Wedged into the benches at the back of the courtroom sat us, two curious journalists, next to some curious old ladies. They'd arrived early to get a good seat, equipped with flasks of tea and a selection of small, neatly cut sandwiches. One lady told us that she and her friends had formed a kind of club to follow the trial. They made sure that at least one of them could go every day and each evening report back what had happened. They couldn't rely on the papers to make the observations they were interested in. The newspapers would tell you about the back and forth between the lawyers and the judge and the witnesses, but they weren't going to recount the look and dress and demeanour of the suspect in the level of detail these ladies were after. It's him they'd come to scrutinise. We saw just how notorious this guy is. National newspapers can put his name and face on the front page with no need to recap the story or his involvement in it. Everyone already knows.
Well, you'll be familiar with him. Unless you live under a rock somewhere, you know. You had to be at the developing dementia or something.
In between court sessions, we took to the markets and pubs around Dublin to ask about him.
And we're copied out from A Girl's Talk, and we've read the book, we're copied out. We're actually hooked on it 24-7.
You know, gun to your head, what do you reckon, did he do it?
Did he do it? I would have said yes.
What gives you that impression, or what makes you feel that?
There's just a badness in him. When you look at him, there's a badness in him, you know.
I actually met him when he was up here the last time.
How come you met him? He was just walking down here?
He was on a break from the court. I said, I know you from the TV. And he got talking. And I looked at him and I said, God, he's such a nice gentleman. However, as we say, that's the outdoor face. We all have indoor faces. And nobody knows, really and truly, nobody knows if there's a murderer among us. It's a real Agatha Christie thing. Nobody knows. They really don't.
Couldn't trust anything coming from the guards. That'd be my opinion now.
The guards were caught up in a run of scandals at the time, and had some people willing to believe the worst about them. That the force might have concocted a case against an outsider in a crime everyone wanted solved.
People would be unwilling to come to an area where they felt there was a killer on the loose, where they felt that, you know, a tourist like her was going to be murdered in her home. I mean, that's the very worst. People love to come to West Cork for the isolation, to come to their holiday home, but to think that there might be a killer outside your window would certainly depress the price of property in the area. And if the person that was blamed was to be not a local and perhaps leave the area quickly, taking the blame with them like the scapegoat being driven out of the village, well, all the better, you know.
So is that what happened? Did an outsider get picked on and framed?
Did a canny criminal outsmart the guards?
Or did someone just get lucky? This next clip is hard to understand. We were talking to one man in a noisy pub when the guy sitting next to him started chiming in.
If you go down there, it'll speak for itself.
He says if you go down there, it'll speak for itself.
They rule the country down there, isn't it, Sandra? You don't go in there and do anything unless they allow you to do it. Did you ever see the film Deliverance? Well, that's all I'm going to say to you, right? You don't go down there and mess with their town.
They rule the country down there. Do you understand me? You don't go down there and do anything unless they allow you to do it. Did you ever see the film Deliverance? Well, that's all I'm going to say to you. You don't go down there and mess with their town. Was he talking about the guards? The locals? Both? Maybe this was just big city talk, but we were curious to see what he meant. And over 3 years, we learned that the impact of this crime extends far beyond this suspect. His fight to clear his name, the titillating question of did he or didn't he do it. It extends to people who got caught up in the investigation and were driven out of town and into hiding. To Paris, where a man who was 15 when Sophie Toscan de Plantier was killed is now fighting for justice for his mother. And it reaches all across West Cork, along the Boreans over Mount Gabriel, and through the outpost towns of Skull, Goleen and Crookhaven.
Back when a trial site for the first transatlantic telegraphs was set up in Crookhaven, one of the signal station operators wrote that arriving here felt like reaching the end of everywhere. The pub at the end of everywhere is O'Sullivan's, and Billy O'Sullivan has lived in Crookhaven all his 80 years. And on this day, he's invited us out on his boat, hauling lobster pots. Growing up, Billy was one of seven. His brothers and sisters were all leaving Crookhaven in search of work, up to Dublin, to the UK, to America. Billy wanted to stay, it's just that there wasn't much to keep him here. He tried his hand as a lighthouse keeper, a fisherman.
And God was a tough mother of God almighty. That was hard work, and the trouble they had with seasick all the time.
Eventually he took over the pub from his father, but it was one of three pubs in a village of just over 100 people.
And if some of them hadn't money and others wouldn't pay, well, oh, for God's sake. You couldn't make a go there at all, you know. But then gradually, it improved.
Tourists started to venture down this way. The first summer home was built. And people in West Cork started to notice new faces around in the off-season. People coming to explore. People like Tom Quinn.
It was fishermen, farmers, small farmers, and very few of the likes of me. Very few.
Like Len with his donkey, Tom was one of the early pioneers of this new movement to West Cork. Tom's a house painter. During this interview, just like every other time we met him, Tom was covered in paint. There was paint on his woolly hat. There's paint all over his Think Outside the Box t-shirt. It's a wonder he can see through the flecks of paint on his glasses. Tom found the place kind of by accident. The first place he stumbled into was Skull, a fishing town that would become the hub of this new community.
I was just driving on this road, and all of a sudden you kind of like, this kind of cinerama scope kind of Cecil B. DeMille kind of scene opens up. And I felt like I was stepping into the past in a kind of an odd way. Do you know? It was like stepping into the past.
Land was cheap. People bought old farmhouses and started growing their own vegetables, rearing animals.
I got into this whole big self-sufficiency thing, you know. I was growing all my own food. I had goats and bees and ducks and hens, and I was catching fish and digging turf and trying to kind of beat the system, you know. I love this place.
People like Tom and Len kept turning up. Ireland joined the European Union in 1973, meaning people could come from all over Europe and draw government benefits. One local put it this way: it's the farthest place you can go and not get your feet wet. If the coast was another 50 miles west, they'd all keep going. Pete Bilecki came here for a holiday sometime in the mid-90s and just never went home.
With the things that were going on in the UK and in Europe, the sort of levels of violence going up, and so what you do is you sort of, you move to the edges where the ripples are less strong. So West Cork was about as far as you could go, wasn't it?
But having the dream is one thing. Actually living it is something else.
It's very quiet in the winter. People who don't know that yet are going to have to keep themselves very busy somehow, or they'll go mad, or they'll split up and go and have affairs, which is quite common, actually.
That's Jules Thomas. She was one of the early settlers. She lives with her partner, Ian Bailey. He abandoned life as a reporter in the UK in search of something a bit more rustic.
Is there something about people who come in the summer? Do you ever look at them and go, oh, I don't fancy
that? Oh, they do fall in love with it in the summer.
Yeah,
they
I think this is the thing.
It's so long and grey and wet.
There's actually a phenomenon that people come, and they maybe come on their holidays, maybe with their children, and they enjoy it so much here, and then they maybe go back to wherever they're going, back to maybe London, and each time they say, oh, do you know, I think I'd really like to live there. I think I could live there. And they come over, but they haven't experienced a winter, perhaps. And the winter is a long, cold, dark period. Very little happens.
West Cork underwent a sort of rural regeneration. The hippies pushed house prices up, and soon they were joined by another well-heeled group. Actors and writers and lawyers who bought second homes down here. It became a sort of playground where the pressures of modern life didn't seem to apply. For a time, it was perfect. But then there was a murder here, and everything changed again.
The whole place was, it was like a tinderbox.
Jim Duggan was one of those lawyers who bought a second home in Skull. 2 years after the murder, he'd find himself representing the suspect. But back then, he didn't even know him. Back then, all he knew was, as much as anyone else, that someone had been murdered, and the killer was still at large.
You were frightened, you know. This was something awful that had happened. And people just couldn't deal with it or cope with it. People locked, double locked their doors. My wife would not go out. My children would not be left out.
It was more than just the immediate fear felt by those that lived around Skull. This kind of thing just didn't square with how the people of West Cork saw themselves.
It's a generous community of people. It's a kind place to live. And this was a huge shock, all the more so because nobody really knew she existed. Almost like she was almost like a sort of phantom that came in and came out of her own accord. And she had slipped through the net of the hospitality and the kindness.
I remember thinking how terribly sad it was, and I remember being embarrassed as well.
Nadine O'Regan grew up in West Cork. Her dad ran the local paper.
I know that sounds like a strange term to use, but you know when somebody who comes in from abroad to live in this beautiful kind of surroundings and then this happens and you're just thinking, like, this isn't what we're like. This isn't, West Cork isn't like this.
The person who, you know, is entitled to come here, who owns a house here, who loves it here, who loves the way of life here, is living way happily and is entitled to do so, and we're glad they're there, is dead, you know? Somebody's killed her, and not only killed her, but killed something else.
Tom Quinn, the house painter again.
I said it to you the last time, Sam. It also killed something here. It took someplace special and made it everywhere else. That's what it done. And it still hasn't gone away.
People talk about this murder as having left a stain on West Cork, as though the landscape itself somehow remembers. A local poet told us West Cork is full of numinous or spiritual places that feel, as she put it, cargoed with mystery. So I think this is the gate she talked about. Can you squeeze through? One place the poet talked about was Three Castle Head. These are the ruins of the last stronghold of one of the old West Cork clans, the O'Mahonys. Back when the Normans were invading Ireland in the 1100s, the O'Mahonys were pushed out onto West Cork's Mizzen Peninsula. They built castles on the sites of old Celtic forts, strategically located to defend themselves from any attack. Three Castle Head is so strategically located that we had trouble finding it.
Okay, let's keep going.
Yeah, but I just think we're really lost.
The wrong way.
To get there, you drive out along the peninsula until the road runs out, and then walk out even further. And just when you're thinking about turning back, you round the top of a hill, and there, by a large lake, are the ruins of three small castles linked by a stone wall.
That's the coldest thing I've ever seen.
See? Oh, the rocks look so sharp.
There's something about it that's completely overwhelming.
So much so eerie.
Yeah, I need some space.
Beyond the castles and down to all sides, there's a sweeping view to the Atlantic hundreds of feet below. And on the day we were there, the wind was moving so quickly across the top of the lake that it looked like something terrifying might burst out of it. You can see why all sorts of myths and legends have been attributed to this place. Some say the bottom of the lake's never been found, but that there's treasure down there, which will bring bad luck to whoever finds it. Which, to be fair, is what you would say if you had treasure buried anywhere. They say the last family to live there all died violently, and to commemorate their deaths, every day a drop of blood drips from the walls of the main tower. But the most common myth at Three Castle Head is of the White Lady, a ghost who haunts the lake, foretelling the death of anyone who sees her.
On her last day alive, Sophie Toscan de Plantier went walking out at Three Castle Head, but something spooked her. The people who own the land live in a farmhouse out there and knew Sophie from her visits. They recall that on that day, she came running to the house having been frightened by something up at the lake. They tried to get her to stay the night, but she insisted on going home. A local guard would later remark to Sophie's aunt that it was a shame the landowners weren't from around there. Had they been local, he said, they would have known not to let someone who'd seen the White Lady off on their own. A whole bunch of myths have sprung up around Sophie's murder. From idle gossip to crazy stories like this. Stories about white ladies and a foretelling of Sophie's death. And maybe it's what happens when there's no resolution to a crime like this. People try to make sense of it and decide on an ending for themselves.
But this isn't folklore. A woman was brutally murdered. Whoever did it got away with it. Early on, a local warned us to remember we weren't investigators. Not the first such warning he'd offered a couple of foolhardy reporters. Over the past 3 years, we've met many people who've been consumed by this case. Haunted detectives, crusading victims, amateur sleuths. We all need to manage our expectations. But surely it's possible to sift out the fiction, to go to the source of the rumours, look them in the eye and discard all the nonsense, and then see what's left.
I think the local feel is, it needs to be finalised.
Leo and Sally Bolger lived less than a mile from Sophie's house.
Oh, that's for sure.
It needs to be, you know, I think for the woman's soul, for the family.
For our family.
You know? It's like the casket can't be closed.
People have to be allowed to put it together for themselves in the end. You know? Even if there is no guilty or innocent verdict. I'd like to hear the whole story. Do you know? And I would like to hear it. with some kind of continuity instead of,
okay,
this fella said that and that one said this and that's rubbish and he's a liar. I'd like to hear the story with all that kind of,
yeah,
taken out of it.
With warts and all gone.
Yeah.
Sophie Toscan de Plantier boarded a plane from Paris on Friday, December 20th, arriving at her home in West Cork that evening. She was spotted alone several times that weekend, browsing clothes in a clothes shop, picking up groceries. On her last day alive, she visited Three Castle Head. By the time she left her friends up there, it was dark, about 6 p.m. She drove the few miles down to Crookhaven, to O'Sullivan's pub. Billy O'Sullivan was behind the bar, and he was the last known person to see her alive.
So can you describe, I mean, this place has obviously changed a bit.
No, it's like exactly
it's
as it
identical.
Was.
And she have the same
stool as there, sitting up there in the usual spot. And she'd usually have tea and scone or something.
He says they chatted for a while, just pleasantries. Sophie made a vague promise to call back in for a Christmas Eve party. She finished her cup of tea and scone, and then she left.
It was a beautiful, still night. Frosty, full moonish, and calm, you could hear, because there were stories all over the place about people hurt or screaming, and maybe they did, you know. And then we don't know what happened after that. But she was found the next morning, battered to death on the road.
West Cork is an Audible original production, written and produced by Jennifer Ford and Sam Bungie. Produced and sound designed by Kristen Muller, Alex Trajano, Robin Wise and Paul Schneider. Our theme music was composed by Shani Avaram. Our recording engineer is Sean Moher. West Cork is edited by Mike Olive. Our fact checker is Christine Baird. And Jesse Baker and Eric Newsom are the executive producers.
This is Audible.
Carthy, as you heard in the headlines in County Cork, are treating as suspicious the death of a woman whose body has been found in a remote area near Skull.
All I heard was that a woman had been found murdered in Tullamore.
But did they say murdered, Kerry?
Yes.
Because I can beg... Did they say murdered?
Yes,
I thought, you know, I was in the influence.
But this
dead.
Was not... They, earlier, it was found dead, but by the time I heard it in the afternoon, they discovered it was a murder. And then I went into the coffee shop in the courtyard and Fanula there told me that it was a French woman.
I think there was no other way of interpreting a single woman being found with head injuries in the middle of the night or, you know, first thing in the morning in a very isolated part of West Cork. It was apparent to everybody who heard that something horrible had taken place that night.
This is West Cork, an Audible original series. I'm Jennifer Ford.
I'm Sam Bungie, and this is Episode 2, The Back of Beyond.
Locals refer to the place where the body was found as the Back of Beyond, even though it's just a few miles out of town. Like a lot of the more remote houses, the victim's home doesn't have a street name or a house number. Instead, people refer to townlands. Some townlands are so small they only cover a couple of houses, and they're not always on maps. They're old Irish geographical divisions that predate the Norman invasion in the 1100s, and have somehow survived despite the cropping up of counties and boroughs and towns. We knew we were looking for a remote area of Tormore called Drinan, but Drinan is so small that if you ask somebody for directions, they know you're looking for the murdered woman's house. We'd heard that locals purposefully give vague directions to ghoulish tourists asking the way to Drinan. We needed someone to help us. The local reporter who covered the case offered to take us out there.
Now, you can see it's pretty isolated. Now, my thinking always was you would never stumble across this place in a month of Sundays. It seems pretty clear to me that the only way you would finish up, or could finish up here, is if you knew the terrain and you knew the place.
Ian Bailey had been a Fleet Street reporter in the UK, but in West Cork, the closest he got to hard news was covering the opening of the first internet cafe or the local Mussels Festival.
The road sort of bends and winds around.
Ian navigated from the passenger seat. The drive is coastal and winding, and then turns up into the hills where there's nothing but briars and rocks.
So you can see, I mean, this is way out. This isn't in a wilderness. Right, I but I wouldn't go any further.
It's on map then, in?
Yeah. So that's the house that was occupied. That was her house. Anyway, I'm just showing you this, so we don't want to be hanging around here.
We were on a dead-end country lane with tufts of grass growing up along it. Up ahead, the lane carries on for 100 metres or so towards a gateway, and then a bend to the right. Then winds up a hillside spotted with three houses. Off to the far right, there's a house nestled behind some trees. To the left, a small cottage. And just in front of it, halfway up the hill and closest to the lane, the victim's house. It's a two-story white farmhouse with a pitched black slate roof and a small porch overlooking rolling farmland down to the Atlantic Ocean. To anyone approaching on this lane that bright December morning in 1996, there would have been nothing that hinted at the horror that lay just around the bend.
If you saw the damage that was done to that poor lady, and you saw the way her face was destroyed, and so on, you would have to come to a conclusion, even if you were never a policeman, that this murder was carried out by somebody that lost it completely.
Dermot Dwyer is a retired detective who worked on the case. He was a senior detective in the city and was called down on the second day to assist the West Cork guards.
I've been at the scene of a lot of murders, and so have my colleagues, but some of them are, you know, there's cruelty in them, and there's viciousness, and she was very badly, it was quite obvious her face had been very badly battered, and she was, and it looked dreadful, to be honest with you.
Her face was bludgeoned. Her hands were gashed and her fingers were broken. There was blood through her hair and on her white nightclothes, more pooled around her head. Her pyjama top was pushed up to her chest. Her pyjama pants were torn at the waist and the elastic waistband still caught on the barbed wire fence. Even though she was in nightclothes, she was wearing laced-up boots. A large, flat piece of slate was next to the body. And nearby, on top of a dark blue bathrobe, a big concrete block, weighing more than 40 pounds. Both the slate and concrete block were covered in blood.
Ireland has one police force for the whole country. It's called An Garda Síochána, which means Guardians of the Peace in Irish. People say guards for short. The local guards down in Skull are part of the same force as the city guards and guards higher up the ranks who join the investigation in the days and weeks to come. The idea was that they'd all work together. The 999 emergency call came in at 10 past 10 a.m. At 10:40, two local guards arrived at the scene. They drove to the end of the lane, where they found a white station wagon with the driver's door wide open. Behind it was the body of a small blonde woman, maybe in their 30s, they thought, lying face up in the ditch. Neither of them recognized the woman, but they recognized the car. It belonged to Shirley Foster and Alfie Lyons, who lived next door. The guards decided that one of them should stay with the body, and the other should go up and speak to them. Shirley and Alfie are a retired couple in their 60s at the time, She's English and had been a school teacher. He's from Dublin and was a restaurant owner. When you think about them picking a place as remote as this and calling it home, it's kind of ridiculous that they ended up with an international homicide investigation on their doorstep. So it made sense that they didn't want to go on tape. In fact, they didn't really want to talk to us, out of respect for the victim and her family, they said. But they were very nice about not wanting to talk. And in being very nice about not wanting to talk, they talked to us a little bit. They told us some stuff about that day, which we'll come back to. But sticking with that morning, it was Shirley who found her. She'd been setting off for Skull to do some Christmas shopping and to take some things to the town dump when she saw something down by the end of the driveway at the gate. It took her a moment to figure out what she was looking at. In fact, her first thought was it was a life-size doll. She was through the open gate and past the body before it registered, and she skidded to a stop. She leant on the horn and screamed for Alfie. Then she ran through the field to their house, where Alfie called 999. The two other houses on the hill were holiday houses. They knew the house on the far right belonged to an English family who were in London, but the house closest to them, about 50 meters down the lane, belonged to a French woman they knew as Sophie Bougnol. They didn't know Sophie well. She only visited a few times a year and generally kept to herself. But there was a silver car in her driveway, and Alfie thought he'd seen her through the window over the weekend. His first thought was to warn the French woman not to go outside. So he ran down the drive and banged on her door, but got no answer. That day, Shirley and Alfie had been too upset to look at the body, and the local guard didn't insist, but he used their phone to call for backup.
We're just going to stop here for a moment to talk about what did or didn't happen at the crime scene that day, because the truth is, we don't really know, certainly not in as much detail as we'd like. One of the first explanations you'll hear about why the case has never been solved is that the guards messed up that first day, that it took the experts too long to get there, and that in the meantime the local guards made mistakes that were impossible to take back. That through sloppiness or inexperience, they destroyed whatever evidence there might have been. None of the local guards we tried wanted to talk, but we did speak to James Donovan. He was in charge of forensics back then. In fact, Donovan introduced forensic science to Ireland in the 1970s. His department was responsible for testing evidence gathered at this scene. He told us what should have happened that day.
Well, the first thing you do is do nothing. Protect the scene. Now, that sounds simple, and yet it is the most difficult thing, because guards want to put their heads in and see what's going on.
Forensic scientists have a sort of unofficial motto. Every contact leaves a trace, which is good because it cuts both ways. They can find a detailed story in a well-preserved scene, but not if someone tramples all over it before they get there.
The last thing you want is any more evidence being added to a scene until it is properly examined. You don't leave fingerprints where there are no fingerprints, or you don't take fingerprints off. The classic thing that all...
To show us, Donovan takes out a hanky and picks up his mug to inspect it, the way detectives do on TV.
It was the horror of seeing somebody get a tissue out of their pocket and lift the object and have a look at it. And of course, the fingerprint under the lift is gone.
Donovan's expertise was so specialised that criminals were constantly trying to rub him out. He survived multiple assassination attempts. A notorious Irish gangster called the General put a bomb in the exhaust of Donovan's car. The explosion took off part of Donovan's lower right leg and most of his left foot. His injuries made it hard for him to stand around in the lab all day, so eventually he just took early retirement. When we visited him at his home in Dublin, it was strange to imagine that this slight man, in his 70s, moving slowly and purposefully around his kitchen, making tea and fishing out the Cadbury snack bars, had been such a powerful enemy of Ireland's criminal underworld. But then he starts talking about forensics, and you think to yourself, if I'd just fled a crime scene, I wouldn't want Donovan anywhere near it.
You're looking for things that almost are beyond viewing. You can't really say at the first glance that that is relevant, that that's not relevant. That's a very dangerous thing to do. You don't know what's going to emerge in time.
Someone who worked in Donovan's lab explained it this way. In a murder, you know you were the one speaking for the victim when gathering evidence.
They can't tell you where to look, so you are acting on their behalf.
You have to do almost a mental scenario of what might have happened, of the potentials of what might have happened. How did the body, if you can associate with the house, how did the body get from the house to there? Why? If she's bloodied there, was she actually bludgeoned there? Was she damaged somewhere else and has run there or been dragged there? Or is there some other area, certainly between the house and there? You could imagine a chase. Was there a chase? Was there blows struck that generated blood? Were her clothes disarranged? Was there attempted sex? What is the evidence to be built up and layer upon layer?
Donovan's forensics team rarely went out to crime scenes and didn't go to West Cork that day. The scenes of crime team were responsible for collecting evidence. A call went out for them at around lunchtime, but they were based in Dublin, 225 miles away.
We can tell you who did get to the scene that day. Father Cashman, the parish priest, he came to administer the last rites. There was some conversation about whether or not he should anoint the body, but they decided no. The holy oils might contaminate the scene.
Pat Joy, a local detective, who'd done a course on crime scene preservation, he brought along his camera and began taking photos.
The local doctor arrived, but it wasn't his job to give anything like a time or cause of death. He could only make official what everyone already knew. This woman was dead.
A farmer who kept cattle down that way, he knew Sophie. And at 12:35 p.m., he ID'd her body for the guards. The body had been out on the road for 2.5 hours since Shirley found it. Police instructions were to leave the body until the pathologist got there.
But Ireland only had one state pathologist, Dr. John Harbison. A call had gone out for him, but he was based in Dublin too, and it was his birthday that day, so he was out of the office. No one had any idea when he might arrive. They hoped he'd be there soon enough to be able to determine the time of death, and that the scenes of crime team would arrive before time and weather destroyed the scene. A local guard was sent to a hardware store in Skull to buy a plastic sheet to protect the body. They put up a warning triangle at the end of the lane, but still, the boot prints piled up.
In the meantime, there was another ticking clock on the killer's whereabouts.
There are certain things that would need to be done fairly quickly, and one of the things would be, are the wounds such that whoever killed her would be sprayed with blood? So, therefore, you're looking for somebody with bloody clothes.
And it sounds like when it came to speaking to people locally, the guards did move quickly and covered a lot of ground in those first hours. Detective Dwyer says the guards had a set list of questions to run through with everyone.
You can get a very good picture of what was moving and what wasn't moving, and it works particularly well in a country place because everyone knows one another and where they're coming from and all that. It's the oxygen that drives a modern investigation.
They wanted to find out who this woman was, who in the area knew her, and they quickly established that not many did. They found out that she used to visit a couple who lived out at Three Castle Head, where she'd been walking the previous day, so they headed out in that direction. They learned that Sophie used to like going to O'Sullivan's pub in Crookhaven, and they found out that another local couple, Leo and Sally Bulger, kept horses on land by her house and came out regularly to feed them. Leo says that Sophie's neighbour, Alfie Lyons, had called them that day to tell them what was going on.
I remember my first actual thought was that that was something that came from France. I didn't believe that that was, you know, something that was instigated here, or I don't know why that was. Certainly not the life here, you know.
That's an area you know, so you know, like, what happens down there.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Nothing happens down there, you know. People can hardly even find a place. It's so remote. So, and I guess maybe that's why I just thought it was something that came with her or followed her or something like that, because, you know, the idea that somebody of anyway local would end up down there. I mean, you couldn't even imagine a situation that would bring that about, you know?
Local guards were hoping for the specialist teams from Dublin Instead, they were getting journalists and curious neighbours. We spoke to one of them.
We heard on the radio just before Christmas that this terrible event had taken place very close to where we lived.
She was a student at the time, home for the holidays. She didn't want us to use her real name. She was worried, as a lot of people were, about sticking her head above the parapet on this. But she said she'd tell us about her December 23rd, when she and her family decided to go and check out the scene for themselves. There was a house up there owned by some friends of theirs who were away, so they told themselves they should go and check that the house was secure.
But clearly it was just a ruse, desperate to see what was going on. So nosy, in typically Irish fashion. So off we all went, piled into the car and drove, and we were astonished that we just kept going. We kept, you know, we drove up a little road and nobody was stopping us. And I kept thinking, surely this can't be possible. We can't still be going. We're going to be turned back. But anyway, the thrill built upon thrill, and we kept going and we powered up the hill. The next thing, we were literally there. We were at the entrance to the drive, and out we get. And we were more shocked than we were excited that we were actually able to get as close as we did to what had only just taken place.
We looked at a photograph of the scene to see exactly where they got to, and it looks like they parked in a field right next to the lane where the body was.
Really, it was quite a casual situation, and the guards were very friendly, and you know, my younger sister was sort of 18 and, you know, chatting very, very amicably with the guard, you know. But I mean, I think that's it goes with the job. When you're a guard in rural Ireland, you engage, and I mean, you engage in friendly banter, possibly to deflect from the reality of what is going on.
But she was also one of the few people in the area who'd been down this road before. She remembers a visit she made as a child to see friends one Christmas evening.
And I remember thinking, this must be the darkest place, and it's so dark. You know, that whole area and that little road, driving it at night is really forbidding. And I think the rest of the landscape is so wide open and characterized by, you know, the Atlantic and the cliffs, and this is just really quiet. It just seemed in its own little dark cocoon.
While Sophie's body was still out on the laneway, before the experts had inspected it, before her family knew, and before the guards really had a grip on the case, Sophie's murder was a national headline. A press officer for the guards was on the 5 o'clock news, already fielding questions.
Now, the body you say was found at 10 o'clock this morning. Is there any idea at this stage roughly how long this woman has been dead?
Absolutely not, no. Again, that's one of the aspects that the pathologist will be looking at, as to the actual length of time the body has been lying there, the cause of death, and of course, formal identification. So we're still waiting for the arrival of the state pathologist, and indeed our ballistics and forensic people here from Garda headquarters to go down and examine the scene. And until such time as that happens, we will not be able to establish exactly the circumstances.
I'm Eugene Gilligan. I was a detective Garda in the Garda Síochána Technical Bureau, which is based in Garda headquarters in the Phoenix Park in Dublin.
Gilligan's team mobilised as soon as they got the call, but a motorway between Dublin and Cork was still about 10 years off being built, so they were on local roads, through every town, hitting Christmas traffic all the way. They didn't get into Skull until 10:30 that night.
And then had to make inquiries to get to the scene, get local police, local Gardaí, to bring us to the scene, because we didn't know where it was. The police station was closed. We had no mobile phones.
Gilligan saw a telephone box, but there was a delay there too.
The telephone had been vandalised, and I literally had to rewire the telephone within the box to make a phone call.
Gilligan finally reached the end of the laneway some 13 hours after Sophie's body was discovered.
It's actually pitch black, but the whole thing is pitch black. It was.
As his eyes adjusted, Gilligan could just make out the three houses on the hillside. A local guard pointed into the darkness where the body lay a few meters up the laneway. The scenes of crime photographer held up a high-watt camera light that cast a narrow band of light immediately ahead of them. Gilligan and the photographer approached the body at a crawl.
We're walking slowly. He's behind me. I look. If it's the ground I'm looking at, looking for footwear impressions, evidence that may look out of place, items that may look out of place, whereas you have, say, fresh cigarettes or something
A few meters up the laneway, the plastic sheeting covering the body came into view. Gilligan inched up around the body and removed the sheeting. He still remembers what he saw.
I do. Absolutely. It's like a picture of where it was. You look and you go, oh, my sake. What's gone on? You look like this and say, what's gone on here? And then you go back out. You're right. Come on, lads. Stand back. Fisher gear. Fisher focus. Start in.
He pointed to injuries he wanted photographed. He checked the temperature of the body. It was nearly freezing. Ireland state pathologist Dr. Harbison still hadn't arrived, but Gilligan knew him well and had worked with him on many cases. He knew the body was now too cold to determine a time of death, and there was little they could do until daylight.
We went back to the station, and I rang Dr. Harbison to explain the scene to him, because we had been informed that he wouldn't have been able to get down until the next morning. We, myself and my colleagues, we saw it immediately as being totally unnecessary to leave a body for the pathologist to come.
Pathologist Dr. Harbison's instruction to Gilligan was to get the body to Cork City, where they could begin a post-mortem as soon as he arrived in Cork the next morning. There was nothing to be got from Harbison visiting the scene, and therefore no point in leaving the body out overnight. Gilligan relayed all this to the local officer in charge, but the local officer had other ideas.
So he said, no, I'd like the doctor to come to the scene. But I said, sir, there's really no need to. I said, the doc can't do anything. Maybe you weren't listening to me. I've just said to you, I want Dr. Harbison at the scene. Okay, sir, thank you. I understand the instruction.
He didn't argue, but he definitely made a note of the conversation.
I said, every word that guy's after telling me you've gone down here, because he said the shit could hit the fan down the road, right?
Gilligan says that he and Dr. Harbison were seen as the experts, and the local officers always deferred to them.
But not on this occasion.
So until Harbison arrived, the body would stay out on the laneway.
We thought it was highly inappropriate to leave the body on the roadside for that length of time. It was somebody's relative, and it had to be treated. That body had to be treated with decorum.
Guards brought out flashlights to the crime scene and worked in shifts to watch over the body.
Guardian Skull are tonight preparing for a full-scale murder hunt over the Christmas period. That's likely to start after the state pathologist carries out a post-mortem early tomorrow morning on the body of the 30-year-old French woman. Darkness tonight accentuated the isolation of the area.
Several people we talked to remembered seeing that the lights were on at the Garda station that night. It stuck in people's minds because it was so unusual. Policing in West Cork, busting people for growing weed or for driving without insurance, could usually wait for daylight hours. Off-season, West Cork is quiet. Not much happens, and even less happens at night.
You know, it was so quiet, it was amazing. So yeah, it would have been possible to wander anywhere and not be seen.
You suddenly realise how vulnerable you are. Previously, isolation is a security. It's also, there's nowhere to run. There's no one to hear you.
In West Cork, you didn't need to think about these kinds of things. Who might be wandering around late at night? How far you were from your closest neighbour? But then a woman was murdered, out in the open. And nobody heard. And nobody saw.
West Cork is an Audible original production, written and produced by Jennifer Ford and Sam Bungie. Produced and sound designed by Kristen Muller, Alex Trajano, Robin Wise and Paul Schneider. Our theme music was composed by Shani Avaran. Our recording engineer is Sean Moher. West Cork is edited by Mike Olive. Our fact checker is Christine Baird. And Jesse Baker and Eric Newsom are the executive producers. was first light on Christmas Eve when Detective Eugene Gilligan entered Sophie's house. He was expecting a homicide scene, signs of a struggle, upturned furniture, broken glass, blood. Instead, the thing that struck him most was how normal everything seemed. Like the anthology of Irish poetry on the kitchen table, held open to a page with a pot of honey, as if someone might return at any moment to finish reading it. The whole house was sparsely furnished, and white. White walls, white stone fireplace. Gilligan remembers the stairs.
But the stairs were painted white glass paint.
It made the house look French, he thought. They were spotless, and it told him Sophie was the type that didn't like shoes to be worn upstairs in the house.
The deceased had slippers, and all her shoes were left at the bottom of the stairs. But we were the first ones with big boots on us walking up the stairs. And our footwear impressions were the only ones on it.
Gilligan looked around the rooms upstairs. He went into the bathroom.
She was in night clothing on the roadside. So we found her clothing that she had removed in the bathroom. We then went to the bedrooms. The bed we set at the time was an unusual bed because it was about a meter, a good meter, built up off the floor.
He'd later learned that Sophie had a bed specially positioned like this.
She liked to read and watch through the window the Fastnet Rock lighthouse light turning between the hills across the road from her. And we also found that she didn't use curtains on her windows. She was a French lady. Nudity didn't bother her, obviously.
This sounds like a prudish guy stereotyping forward French women. But what Gilligan was wondering was Sophie being watched that night? As far as Gilligan could tell, after surveying the house, there was no sign of anyone but Sophie.
Her house was her house, and she had the inside decorated and left as she wanted it. And that's what we found when we went in.
This is West Cork, an Audible original series. I'm Sam Bungie.
I'm Jennifer Ford, and this is episode 3, Sophie Bunyol.
The circumstances surrounding the murder of Madame de Plantier are quite mysterious as to why she should decide to spend Christmas alone in West Cork when she had a child and a husband in France. The killing has shocked the village of Skull in West Cork and where many foreigners keep holiday homes. Madame du Plantier had kept herself secluded from the local population on her visits and they didn't know a lot about her.
She was blonde, very attractive girl, I thought. Very discreet, and when all this happened, one, you never take any notice of routine things, you know. But then, of course, when they crashed, everything she did was scrutinised.
I think the first thing came out was she was a glamorous French film director's wife.
She came over with different men, and she was having relationships with, if not all of them, at least one of them.
She was very a very gentle person. She wasn't forward.
I would have said there was deep sadness somewhere. You know, and, yeah. So for whatever her reasons for coming to West Cork, I don't know.
Sophie Toscan de Plantier was 39 years old. She was a television producer. She made art house documentaries for French TV. Her father was a dentist. Her mother was deputy mayor of a central district in Paris. They both still live in the apartment where they raised Sophie and her two brothers. Sophie was petite, just over 5 feet tall, with blue eyes and a face covered with freckles. She had blonde hair that she wore simply, either loose by her shoulders or just pushed back off her face. Everyone who knew Sophie stresses that she didn't flaunt her beauty. But still, you could picture her fending off wolf-whistling Parisian men on mopeds. At the time of her death, Sophie was married to Daniel Toscan de Plantier. He was one of France's most famous movie producers and was 16 years older than her. He'd worked with legendary European filmmakers.